For the last 1500 years, Catholic theology has been shaped by the enduring influence of two intellectual giants, St. Augustine and St. Thomas Aquinas. Now, a third figure has appeared to present the faith of the Church in the language of our own age. Explore the dynamics of the teaching of Pope John Paul II on the program Faith for Today with Father Richard Hogan.
Hello, my name is Father Richard Hogan. I'm a priest of the Archdiocese of St. Paul in Minneapolis, and with the permission of our Archbishop there, I work full-time with Priests for Life. But I'm here at EWTN Radio to do a series of programs on Pope John Paul II's understanding of the Catholic faith. So we will be considering all of the doctrines of the faith, all of the moral teachings of the faith, in accordance with the mindset of the present Holy Father, John Paul II. His approach is different, has a different flavor, a different way of speaking than some of the previous ways of doing it, and we will explain these differences in the first two programs. Today, I want to do some background work on John Paul II. He's known throughout the world as the promoter of life and the dignity of every single human person from the moment of conception to the point of natural death. And he is incredibly significant in the history of the Church. And we can see this particularly, I think, through an analysis of what has happened in the world of catechetics, or the world of the way we teach the faith. It's pretty clear to many of us who have been involved in the Church for a number of years, certainly since the Second Vatican Council, that there is a different way that we teach the faith today than there was in the past. And in many cases, it seems that the faith is not being transmitted with the same vigor and the same clarity that it had been in the past. What happened? How did this all come about? Well, one possible explanation is that the way most of us learn the faith, those of us who are at least 40 or over, and perhaps even 35 and over, the way we learn the faith from little on, from preschool all the way up through graduate school and seminary and post-seminary and post-doc theologians, the way we learn the faith was the synthesis of St. Thomas Aquinas. Now, what we mean by a synthesis is a union of philosophy and revelation. Revelation is what Christ came to teach us about God and man, and reflections on that are called theology, or the study of God. Now, philosophy is the study of the existence of things in the world, but most especially, and at the highest level, the study of the existence of the human person. Theology is the study of the existence of God, based on what Christ told us and what had been revealed by God in the Old Testament. But because human beings are created in God's image and likeness, philosophy and theology touch one another. Because obviously, in order to study the existence of human beings as images of God, you need to know something about God. And so it touches on theology. And obviously, theology touches on man, because the whole point of God's revealing himself is so we would know where we are going and who we are and why God created us. So the two are related to one another. And the synthesis, or that word in theology, has meant a union of philosophy and theology, or a union of philosophy and the reflections on revelation. Now, in the history of the Church, classically, there have been two great syntheses of the faith. The first was that of St. Augustine, who used the philosophy of Plato, a Greek philosopher, used the philosophy of Plato as a means or a vehicle for teaching the faith. The second great synthesis was that of St. Thomas Aquinas in the 13th century. St. Augustine lived in the 5th century in North Africa, Bishop of Hippo. He died in 430 as the Vandals were besieging his town. The synthesis that he put together, that of Plato and theology, Plato and Revelation, lasted from 430, the date he died, until the 13th century, almost 800 years. St. Thomas came along, and in the 13th century, in the 1200s, people no longer thought in the same vein and in the same way as they did in the age of St. Augustine. And so there was a need for a new language, a new way of expressing the faith. Now, one of the reasons that they were no longer thinking in the vein or in the categories of St. Augustine was because the Greek works of the philosopher Aristotle had been filtering into Western Europe. In the 12th century, Aristotelian works that had not been known, had not been transmitted through the various monasteries of the 4th, 5th, and 6th centuries, filtered into Europe through translations from Arabic. They had been translated from Greek into Arabic for the Arabic or Muslim world, and then they were translated, mostly in Spain, from Arabic into Latin, which then made them available for the new universities which were springing up in the 12th century. And this yielded new discoveries, new ways of thinking, new ways of thought. And certainly Abelard, for example, a great intellectual figure of 12th century France, 1100s, certainly reflects this new tradition. However, the problem with these Aristotelian works was, first of all, they were bad translations in the sense that they went through two translations, from Greek to Arabic, then Arabic to Latin. The second thing is, because they came to the Muslim world, they were tainted with Muslim influences and with Muslim commentary. So they weren't the clear works that Aristotle had originally written. By the time you get to the 13th century, there were better translations which went from Greek to Latin, and these came through the Crusader states that had been established by the various Crusades in the Holy Land. And these Latin kingdoms had people who knew Greek as well as Latin, and they could translate the Aristotelian texts originally from the Greek into Latin, and then these were promulgated or sent through Western Europe. And these new works, new to the 13th century and in better translations, so there were better translations of some things that had come in the 12th century, but there were also new works that were translated for the first time into Latin. These new works changed the intellectual outlook of many, many people. There then needed to be a new way of teaching the faith that would be updated. Now that sounds funny for the 13th century from our point of view, but that was the situation. There was a renaissance of thought in the 12th century, which led to this great flowering in theology in the 13th. And St. Thomas's great works were a fruit of this. He put together the synthesis using Aristotelian philosophy and the Catholic faith. Now, in the 20th century, in our own era, there has been a similar development. This has been coming on for a long time. It wasn't quite as quick as happened in the 12th and 13th century. It was begun with the scientific revolution in the Renaissance. The whole medieval world thought objectively, thought in terms of principle, and thought deductively in a syllogism. For example, all bikes have two wheels. This is a bike. This has two wheels. People don't talk that way anymore, but that was the way that the 13th century thought almost entirely. Now remember, when I say the 13th century, I'm only talking about 1 or 2% of the people, because most people were involved in agriculture and they could hardly read, let alone think in these terms. So we're talking about a very small number of people, of scholars who functioned at the universities and in the church, sometimes in government bureaucracies, although the kingdoms were not anywhere close to where the church was or the universities were. Most of the kings and queens could write and were literate, but they weren't great intellectuals and they were not capable of what many people are today. So when we're talking about thought patterns of the 13th century, we're not talking about large groups of people. Today, of course, things are quite different. And this scientific revolution is based on the experiential method. Theoretically, one experiment in a high school lab could disprove an entire law of science. It just takes one. And in terms of democracy, we count heads. We say things like, that may be true for you, but not for me. Now, all of these ways of doing things would be totally foreign to the medieval world, to the medieval synthesis. So the subjective way we think, that may be true for you but not for me, the experiential method, that is that one little experiment can undo a law of science that's been around, or a theorem of science that's been around for decades, and the idea we count heads inductively, all of this is a whole new pattern and way of thinking. And it's not the way the medieval world thought, which was objective. I mean, if something's true, it's true, period. It's not true for you or true for me. It's true. It's real. It's as much true for you as it is for me, the objective world. Principle as opposed to experiential, and deductive, top-down rather than inductively. Now, this new way of thinking means that we need a new way of explaining the faith or teaching the faith, a new language that makes sense in terms of the thought patterns we have today. Now, as I mentioned, this really began with the Renaissance. It's been continuing for a long time. The sole reason why the older way of teaching the faith lasted so long was because, especially in our own country, that is to say in the United States and Canada, there was a kind of self-imposed Catholic ghetto. This is not a negative term. It was something that the Catholics wanted. Immigrant groups, one after another, would gather together around the parish community. And there were a number of reasons for this, language reasons, as well as that they felt that they were not treated in the social spheres or economic world, financial world, political world as equals with the other Americans who had been in the country for generations. And so they would, for protection and for their own sanity, they would gather around in these groups. And the parish was often the center of this. So there were German parishes and Italian parishes and Czech parishes and French parishes, Irish parishes. The Irish, of course, had a little bit easier time in that they spoke English, whereas the other immigrant groups did not. So that there's this kind of Catholic ghetto. And the Catholic ghetto included the Catholic school system. And the good sisters who taught us took each and every immigrant group and taught them so successfully that they mainstreamed them. They enabled them to move out of this narrow social group into the wider world of American society. And what that eventually did was it broke down the ghetto. See, the ghetto worked in terms of theology because the sisters taught the language, taught the objective, principled, and deductive way of thinking of St. Thomas Aquinas. And the faith then was taught that way. So there was a kind of a God talk. The sisters taught the language, and when you heard the language in church on Sunday from Father, you knew exactly what he was saying. But the mainstreaming of various generations of Catholics, moving them into the main society of American culture, broke down this ghetto. The very success of the Catholic school system meant that there was no longer the same kind of close-knit social group, close-knit educational system, and because of that, the language was no longer taught and learned in the same way that it had been before. So by 1960, and of course, the symbolic breaking of the ghetto was the election of a Catholic Irishman as president of the United States, the election of John Kennedy in 1960. This symbolically was the moment in which the close-knit social group of the church, and especially the closed educational system, and of course by closed, we're talking millions of people, so it wasn't narrow, it was simply for Catholics. This all kind of gradually broke apart because of its own success. The good sisters took us mainstream generation after generation, and they all moved out into the general wider social milieu of American culture, and this broke down the closed group. And so the language no longer was taught. People didn't understand what Father was talking about on Sunday. There had to be a new way of teaching the faith. And this is precisely with John Paul II, John the 23rd called for when he called for the Second Vatican Council. When you go back and read the speech that he gave in 1958, calling the Second Vatican Council, he said he wanted a new way of teaching the faith, a new language. Now, it's unclear as to whether or not he really understood precisely what he was asking for, but certainly the Holy Spirit did. He wanted a new presentation of the faith, a new language, which would fit the modern way of thinking, the modern way of teaching the faith. Clearly, this is the same thing that happened with St. Thomas. Every so often there has to be a renewal of the language used to teach the faith so that it makes sense in terms of the people listening today. I'm Father Richard Hogan, Associate National Director of Priests for Life. We're talking about John Paul II and Catechetics. Write us at P.O. Box 141172, Staten Island, New York, 10314, or call us at 718-980-4400. Visit our website at www.priestsforlife.org. In any case, John the 23rd in 1958 called the Vatican Council and wanted a new way of teaching the faith. And that's precisely what he receives through the Second Vatican Council. Because in the same year that he called the council, 1958, Karol Wojtyła, now Pope John Paul II, as an auxiliary bishop in Krakow, gave a speech where he linked the reference in Genesis to our creation in the image and likeness of God to Revelation. Now, this may sound, well, that's pretty trite. It's, after all, the first chapter of the Bible. What's so significant about that? Well, the way he did it was that created individually, uniquely. We're all special orders. We're all created like God. This saves the individual, experiential, subjective, and inductive viewpoint because each one of us is individual. Each one of us obviously is subjective. Each one of us has our own experiences, and we're created like God. So if someone comes and says, I'm a person, I've got rights, for example, your high school 15-year-old or a 30-year-old, anybody comes to you and says, hey, I'm a person, I've got rights, I'm created like God, I'm what's true for me is true, and my experiences are valid, and so on. Yes, you affirm all that. You say exactly right, and you know why? Because you're created like God. And being created like God, obviously that gives us a tie to the objective, principled, and deductive reality, the greatest reality in the universe, God himself. What sometimes I say to parents is, when your son or daughter comes and say, hey, I've got rights, I'm a person, I'm an individual, I can do whatever I want, and so forth and so on. You don't deny it. You don't say, no, you're not, and as long as you're in this house, you're going to do what I tell you to do. You say to the person, you say to the son or daughter, yes, you're right, you are an individual, you do have rights, you are free. And you know why? You're created like God. Now act like it, which means to act like God himself, which means to act like Christ, which means to keep the commandments. You see, you have immediately a tie to the objective order. It brings the two worlds together. It brings the world of the Renaissance, of the scientific revolution, together with the world of the Middle Ages, the world of the faith. Now, in catechetics, which, of course, is the topic of this whole presentation, in catechetics, you see, you had the older synthesis in all of the books. And with the Second Vatican Council, the teachers, principals, leaders in education had, quote, the permission, if you will, to throw out the old books. And they wanted to do it because they could see it wasn't working anymore. To try to use the older language of St. Thomas Aquinas is like trying to teach a foreign language. For example, if you use the word transubstantiation, and be very clear about this, I'm not saying it can't be used, and I'm not saying it shouldn't be used. But I'm saying when you try to use that word, you're talking about substance and accident. Substance in the medieval terminology means that which exists in itself. Accident are those things which exist in substances. But if you say substance to the average adult crowd today, or a teenage classroom, or even a grade school classroom, if you say the word substance, they do not think of things which exist in themselves. They think of drugs. And if you say accident to people, they think of two cars bumping together. Now, if you're going to redefine those terms, if you're going to say accident doesn't mean two cars bumping together, not on purpose, and you're going to say these are things which may or may not exist, and they exist in substances, you're creating a new language. You're saying this word means this, not what you think it means. Same thing with substance. You're saying it doesn't mean drugs, it means things which exist in themselves. Now, if you can get a classroom to sit still to learn the foreign language that this is, it's wonderful. The Thomistic system is one of the greatest accomplishments of Western intellectual thought. But it's easier to teach the faith in language that the kids already understand, rather than trying to teach the foreign language of the medieval worldview. The difficulty, and that's what the teachers were saying when they threw out all the catechetical books, the difficulty was in trying to unite the faith with the new language. They erred, and they erred seriously, because it is a very difficult thing to do to take an experiential, subjective, and inductive language and unite it with the faith that's been tied to an objective, principled, and deductive world. And what happened, the emphasis on experience in the catechetical texts and the emphasis on subjective reality and inductive methodology led to serious errors. For example, usually in textbooks today, when you look at them, they start out teaching the Eucharist with the family meal. And that leads to errors because the family meal becomes the norm for the Eucharist when it should be the other way around. The other problem is in throwing out the system, the order in theology, they lost the connection. So you have vignettes, if you will, subject matters not connected to each other. Remember one time I walked into a classroom and I asked the kids, is Jesus God? And this was 7 or 8 years of Catholic education. Half of the kids could not tell me that Jesus is God. Now, how was that possible? This was a good school. It was a good program. How was it possible that after 7 or 8 years of Catholic education, the kids did not know the divinity of Christ? Well, it's because of the lack of system. You see, we teach the kids that Jesus is Son of God, which is absolutely scriptural, absolutely true. And we teach the kids in the baptism lesson that they are children of God, which is absolutely true. And the minds of the children work the way God created them to work, that is to say, logically. And so the kids say, okay, I'm a child of God, and I'm not God. And Jesus is Son of God, which means child of God. So he's the same as me. And since I'm not God, neither is he. And it's absolutely correct, except it isn't, because there's a piece missing. And the piece is missing because there's no connection between the Eucharist lesson and the baptism lesson. And they conclude this, and it's wrong. It's also because they do not teach the Trinity. And I'm not talking about teaching the 400 pages of St. Augustine's De Trinitate. All I'm talking about is teaching the kids the sign of the cross, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, which is the way you teach the Trinity to the youngest children. You must teach the Trinity, but the emphasis on the experiential, inductive, and subjective world says you don't teach things that the children do not understand. And since they cannot understand the Trinity, you don't teach it. Of course, the response to that is, well, who of us does understand the Trinity, and when would you teach it if the whole idea is to wait until one can understand it? Because even in heaven, you won't. But you see, if you don't teach Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, then obviously the Jews were right and Jesus can't be God because there is only one God and he's in heaven and Jesus isn't God. So there are three errors here. The first one is the emphasis on experiential, subjective, and inductive method leads to errors in the faith because you make human experience and human subjective reality the norm for divine truths. The second one is an error in system. There is no system, so there's no connection between the various things. And the third problem is this idea that you can't teach certain doctrines because people don't understand them. At any rate, what you ended up with in the 60s and 70s, and to a certain extent we're living with this still today, is textbooks which are wonderfully modern pedagogically, that have all of this wonderful experiential ideas that emphasize the subjective mode and inductive methodology, but don't teach the faith. Or you have, on the other hand, wonderfully rich doctrinally sound textbooks, but use the Thomistic system and really, in effect, teach the faith using language and terms which come from the Middle Ages. Now, there's got to be something in between. Enter John Paul II, because he is the one who is able to marry the inductive, subjective, and experiential world of today with the objective, principled, and deductive world of the faith through his reference to the fact that we're created in God's image and likeness. Because if we're created like God, we're all special orders. In other words, Michelangelo on this ceiling of the Sistine Chapel got it right, where the finger of God touches only Adam. Each and every one of us is specially individually created by God. And yet, if we are going to be true to ourselves as images of God, we have to know God and we have to act like him. In other words, in order to be a human being, you have to know who you are and you have to act like a human being. But to know who you are, if you're an image of God, you have to know God. And to act like a human being, you have to act like God. So you have to know who God is and how God acts. Therefore, the reference in the Pastoral Constitution on the Church in the Modern World, Gaudium et Spes, paragraph 22, where the fathers teach that Christ reveals man to man himself, makes perfect sense. As an image of God, we do not understand who we are or how we should act unless we know who God is. And Christ reveals the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. And so he shows us and tells us, shows us is a better way to put it, shows us who we are and how we should act by showing us God. So Christ reveals man to man himself. That's the linchpin, the kingpin, if you will, of the union of the phenomenology, which is the modern philosophical movement John Paul II is steeped in, with the idea of the faith. It's a new synthesis, a new way of teaching the faith with its own language. And this idea that Christ reveals man to man himself is the basis for the whole thing. And you can build, as John Paul II has and is doing, a whole new way of teaching the faith based on this synthesis. Now, we'll have more on this in the next show. Remember, my name is Father Richard Hogan, Associate National Director of Priests for Life. We're located at on Staten Island, New York, 10314, P.O. Box 141172. Call us at 718-980-4400 or visit our website at www.priestsforlife.org. God bless, and we'll see you in the next show.
Join us again next time for Faith for Today with Father Richard Hogan here on EWTN Global Catholic Radio.